At an AFL-CIO convention in December of 1961, Martin Luther King Jr. said, and I quote, "The labor hater and labor baiter is virtually always a twin-headed creature spewing anti-Negro epithets from one mouth and anti-labor propaganda from the other mouth." Again, this was from an AFL-CIO convention in December of 1961. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Not unlike Martin Luther King Jr., today's guest, Bill Fletcher Jr., has been described as a proud disruptor, someone who shakes up the status quo to create social change, indeed, an unyielding voice for justice. An unyielding voice for justice. Bill Fletcher Jr., welcome to Mind Talk.
I'm really glad to be back, Pam. Thank you so much.
It is always a delight to have you. And of course, you know that today we're going to be talking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy with respect to labor. So let's just, if you can, in a nutshell, tell us what he fought for. What were his interests in labor?
Well, I would actually say that Martin Luther King was probably one of the greatest labor leaders of the 20th century. I didn't say, as you notice, a trade union leader, but a labor leader. He was someone who spoke for the interests of working people consistently. And he integrated, no pun intended, the issue of racial justice and economic justice throughout his career. Many people focus only on the end of his life when he was involved in the Poor People's Campaign and the support of the Memphis sanitation workers. But that's inaccurate. As the historian Michael Honey from the University of Washington has demonstrated, King was consistently an advocate for working people. And interestingly, was on a regular basis suggesting to the trade union movement that it was not doing enough to address the concerns of working people insofar as it failed or was uneven in taking on racial justice. So when you get to 1967, when King, of course, gives his famous speech against the Vietnam War, but also begins the plans around the Poor People's Campaign, he had, by that time, regularly been someone who would appear at trade union gatherings, would be speaking out around working people. And one of the issues, it's very timely, Pam, that he regularly spoke out against was what's called right-to-work laws. And I say it's very timely because the Supreme Court is going to be issuing a decision later this spring in a case called Janus versus the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees that will essentially open up all public sector work to right to work. That is, where workers can gain the benefits of a union but not have to pay any kind of fee nor join. And King pointed out, I believe as early as the late 50s, that right to work, which had been constructed by a known racist and right-winger named Vance Muse, was antithetical to the interest of black workers.
And it, as I hear you describing it, it makes a lot of sense, but I'm going to ask you to say a little bit more for the listeners who perhaps may not have a full awareness of what you're referring to.
Sure. So when the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, Congress passed it in part because they were really worried about this developing new labor movement. And they were also worried about what they viewed as industrial civil war, and that unions would be competing with one another and it'd be chaos. So they included in the statute the notion that of what's called exclusive representation. In other words, that if a union wins an election to represent workers, or if it is recognized by an employer, that that union represents all of the workers who are eligible, all. And in 1944, the Supreme Court went further and emphasized that as a result, the union had to represent fairly and equitably all of these workers and could not discriminate. And it could not discriminate even if someone happened not to be in a union. So in the 1940s, the late 1940s, Republicans passed amendments to the National Labor Relations Act. And those amendments, one of those amendments was something called right to work. It's a great PR term. It has nothing to do with the ability of someone to work. It would be better called the right to be greedy, because what it does is that it says that an individual who works in a place that has union representation need not join that union, need not pay the union anything, but the union is obligated to represent them, including taking their cases to arbitration, all of which costs money. And so one way for you listeners to think about it would be like this. I want you to imagine a city, a town, or a state where taxation is voluntary, but where you living in that city, town, or state will be given water, sewer, police, fire, and education for nothing. And if anyone listening can identify one place in the United States that fits into that, we should talk. I've not been able to find a place. And it's obviously absurd. But what the Republicans were trying to do was to weaken the unions
Sure.
by having them spend money on people who were not contributing. Well, King recognized that this was aimed at weakening the power of unions. And he was particularly concerned about unions in the South and the possibility that strong union movement in the South could elevate all workers, but particularly black workers. So he warned people against being hoodwinked by this notion of right to work. Unfortunately, much of the union movement was very complacent, and over the years, right to work has spread, and it spreads using all kinds of misinformation. You know, particularly, you know, emphasizing that you as an individual don't need to worry about paying anything, but you'll be represented, which begs a question. If not enough people are paying into the union, what ultimately happens to the union?
Absolutely.
Well, the answer is obvious. It collapses, which was the objective of the architect of right to work and all of those who have supported it.
You know, Bill, it occurs to me that for those who are listening, Mind Talk is clearly a mental health relationship health program. And there may be some folks thinking, what does labor have to do with that? And I just would like to point out, and I would certainly like your comments as well, that if you are not in a position where you have the ability to take care of yourself, that gets in to feed yourself, to feed your family, to feed your loved ones, to house yourself, family, loved ones, etc. That gets at one of the very core issues of one's ability to feel good about oneself and to function. So when we talk about labor, it's with the understanding that this is one of the bedrocks, if you will, of one's emotional well-being. What are your thoughts?
I not only agree with you, I'll go one step further. The non-union workplace in the United States is, generally speaking, an authoritarian environment. In other words, workers go to work in non-union workplaces and they give up most of the rights that they assume that they have in the outside world, with the exception of very specific statutory rights like against racial discrimination, sex discrimination. But when you go into a workplace that's not represented by a union, you are giving up your freedom of speech, your freedom of association. You're in an environment where you can be easily manipulated, where you can be fired for any reason or no reason, as long as it doesn't violate a statute. And this contributes to undermining the self-esteem of workers. It plays workers against one another. I can't tell you how many workers, when I was a paralegal years ago, Pam, and then when I started working for unions, I can't tell you the number of workers who had been in non-union workplaces that would come to me, and they would look, I don't quite know how to sign it, maybe as if a hand grenade had gone off. They're completely traumatized, and they're saying, I don't understand why I was fired. You know, I tried everything that I could. I was a good worker, and yet I was fired. And you'll have that among workers who are fired, workers who are laid off, who go through, and I'm sure you've experienced this and run across this in your work, people who will basically, they'll blame themselves. What did I do?
Absolutely.
Or what didn't I do? And they internalize the whole problem when in many, if not most cases, it wasn't that they did something. It was completely out of their control because they had absolutely no power in the workplace.
Bill, you made reference to your own background, and I'd just like to share, take a mini look at what your particular background is. You have been an activist since your teen years, and
correct.
Upon graduating from Harvard University, you decided to work as a welder in a shipyard. Now, the last Harvard graduate that the world was very much aware of, his name was Barack Obama, and he was often referred to as an elitist. So you were an elitist in the shipyard?
Well, Pam, here's the deal. I decided that I wanted to get involved in the labor movement, and I was inspired by a number of different factors and individuals. I, as you mentioned, had been active since high school. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was in junior high school. I was very much influenced by the Black Panther Party, and I saw myself as someone that wanted to work with and serve the oppressed. That's the way I framed it. When I was in college, I got to know the chairman of the Afro-American Studies Department, a great gentleman named Ewart Gannier. And if the last name sounds familiar, it's because that was Lonnie Gannier's father. And Gannier had been a trade union leader in the 1940s and eventually ended in academia. And the way he taught Afro-American studies was very unique. It was not famous Negroes I've known. It was talking about social movements, struggle, masses of people. And one of the things he emphasized was the role of unions and the potential role that unions could play as an instrument for advancing racial justice if done the right way. I was very inspired by that. And I decided when I graduated, that I wanted to start it as a rank and filer, not go in as a staff person. I felt like I had a lot to learn. So I went to work as a welder in a shipyard. Now, they didn't know I had gone to Harvard. They would never have hired me had they known I had gone to Harvard. So I went in just as a regular guy. And I always say it was part two of my education. I went to a college that trained people to become part of a global ruling class. And it instills in you a level of arrogance that is both overt and subtle. And then I went to work with people, most of whom had never been to college or completed college, who taught me more about life than you could ever believe, including about welding. And it was a very humbling experience, one of the most important in my life. And it prepared me to be a real union activist. It was very challenging. It was very dangerous physically. I fell while I was there, fell 20 feet. It was very dangerous, but it was very illuminating.
You mentioned the Black Panther Party, and mm-hmm. you describe yourself as a Marxist. So those
right.
are concepts that at first blush, many people send them running into the woodwork. Talk about being a Marxist. What does that mean? And also talk, if you would, for a moment, just about what the Black Panther Party was doing and what it was all about.
Let me start there.
Okay.
So in the fall of 1967, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X. I was 13 years old. My parents had it. It was a paperback edition. Didn't have any pictures. Wasn't about war. Wasn't the traditional thing that I was reading at that time. And, you know, every so often we would read Muhammad Speaks, which was a newspaper of the Nation of Islam, and I was interested in the foreign coverage, international coverage. But I wasn't influenced by the theology of the Nation of Islam. So I read the autobiography, and it changed me, changed my life. And by the time I ended the book, I felt like I now know what I need to do with my life, and that I need to be radical in the way that Malcolm was. I needed to devote myself to social justice. Wasn't quite sure what that meant in a concrete way at the age of 13, but it was around the same time of the rise of the Black Panther Party, which was a radical black organization that not only was challenging racism, but was demonstrating that there was a direct connection between racism and the capitalist economic system. And I found that really fascinating. And I became, I was encouraged to study more. The Panthers encouraged this, not just of me, but of people around them to read. There were people I went to high school with who barely read what they were assigned to, but when they became radicalized, my God, they were reading everything. Just unquenchable. And I started reading more and more, understanding about U.S. foreign policy, the crimes that the U.S. had committed internationally, the history, the real history of the United States. And I believed that we needed a fundamental transformation. So when you ask about Marxism, Marxism is a theory of emancipation. It's a theory that says, in essence, that the capitalist system is antithetical to the survival of humanity, that it is a system that is the first amoral system in this on this planet. It has no morality. You can identify it as immoral as well, which I do, but it basically lacks morality. When you get into the system, it doesn't matter what your intentions are. Capitalism drives towards the accumulation of profits before all else. And it crushes people, and it crushes the environment. And so I became attracted to this notion that there needed to be a fundamental transformation. And that if we want peace, if we want a different kind of environment, if we want real women's rights and rights for gays, lesbians, and others, if we want a change in the relationship of the United States to the rest of this planet, this system gets in the way. So that really inspired me. In fact, in getting involved in the trade union movement, I didn't get involved looking at the unions as a panacea. I looked at them as organizations of working people that could do very good things if they had the right kind of leadership and if the membership was inspired. And so that's a lot of what I've devoted my life to. That's one of the reasons that I became very, very involved in worker education, membership education, because I think that helping people develop a framework, which is one of the things that we lack, many of us lack. We have, many people don't really have a framework or a consistent framework to look at the world. And a consistent framework really helps you understand who are your friends and who are your enemies.
Bill, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation that I'm having with Bill Fletcher Jr., who has, as I said a little bit earlier, been described as an unyielding voice for justice. We'll be right back. Had the opportunity to talk with Dr. King today about the current state of labor in the United States today, what would you say?
I would say, first, I would offer an apology and a self-criticism for my failure to fully appreciate his broader significance and thinking when he was alive. That's where I would start. And that, like many other younger activists, we pigeonholed King, counterposed him to Malcolm X, and did not fully appreciate the breadth of his vision. That's where I would start. Second thing is, I would explain to him that we are, that is, the trade union movement, is in an existential crisis. And that despite his often poetic pleas to the trade union movement to become more than it was, to become what A. Philip Randolph described as the essence of trade unionism as social uplift, that we had failed. And that while I don't think that the failure is necessarily terminal, it is a failure that has contributed to the depth of the crisis. And then what I would do is I would want to talk with him about strategy. Because one of the things that many people, particularly younger people or people that have not studied the civil rights movement, failed to appreciate, was the extent to which King was such a brilliant strategist. He wasn't just a great speaker. He was a real strategist, and he was certainly a visionary. Malcolm X was a visionary. Malcolm X was certainly one of the greatest orators of the 20th century. I'm not sure that Malcolm was as much of a strategist as King. King really looked at how to bring various movements together and how to frame the issue, the target, in a way that spoke to the concerns of the component parts of a movement. And it's a very unique skill. And it's a skill that many people fail to appreciate. And I would love the opportunity to talk with them about strategy. There's not enough good strategists out there. There are many people that obsess on tactics. And tactics are important, don't get me wrong. But they're important only in insofar as they advance a strategy. Other than that, they're irrelevant. So there are some people that are great tacticians. They know how to fight and win battles, but they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily good strategists. They don't necessarily understand the depth and length of a campaign or how to win a war. I would love that opportunity.
As you are describing Dr. King, you use words, you use descriptors, a tremendous strategist, a visionary. What would you share with Dr. King about our current political agenda? And perhaps there are more than one.
Well, one thing I would say to him is that after April 4th, 1968, the Black Freedom Movement found itself on a plateau. And in many respects, it's not been able to get off that plateau. That when King talked about, you know, getting to the mountaintop, to utilize that metaphor in some ways, I'd say that he may have gotten to the mountaintop. We got to the plateau. And our movement, I'm talking about the Black Freedom Movement, and has been baffled about how to go forward. It's been torn. There's been very deep divisions. And I don't blame this, certainly don't blame this on King. Nor do I situate this as only in connection with his assassination. It's that the Black Freedom Movement accomplished amazing things in the 1960s, but it reached a certain point, and this is what King appreciated. It reached a certain point where it needed to go forward in connecting racial justice to economic justice and, much like Malcolm X, internationalizing our struggle. And what happened after 68 was that the movement splintered. There were the black capitalists that felt like, okay, now that I have fewer obstacles and I can make money, everything is hunky-dory. There were those who basically said, okay, integration has been won, so we're fine. We're not restricted in the same way that we were to certain communities. And it was in the late 70s when you had a black electoral upsurge that started, that took off again, a second upsurge that culminates in Jesse Jackson's presidential campaigns in 84 and 88, that you see us on the verge of getting off of the plateau. But we weren't able to. And so I would identify this as a central problem. It's also the type of problem I would have wanted to talk with King about, because it has resulted in immense confusion. The overt obstacles to our progress, like Jim Crow segregation are gone. And when you have the elimination of overt obstacles, then the problem that emerges is when there are still obstacles, but not necessarily as visible, people can become confused. They can start blaming themselves. They can start blaming others, but don't understand the nature of the system that we're up against. And I think that that's part of the problem that we've had since April 4th, 1968.
When you talk about the difference between an overt obstacle and perhaps a covert obstacle, I want to sort of marry that those concepts with our current political environment.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff that perhaps was covert in the past that is anything but in the present. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, it's funny you raise it because I was in a discussion, actually doing an interview yesterday, and I said that from 1968 until 2015, in many respects, we were dealing with what people have frequently called dog whistle politics coming out of large sections of the right wing. And by dog whistle politics, what they mean is that racially coded terms are used, but they're not explicit. So, for example, 1968, Richard Nixon's campaign, central to his campaign, was what was called the Southern Strategy. But the Southern Strategy was not a Southern strategy. It was a white people strategy. It was the objective of the Southern Strategy was to paint the Democratic Party as the black party and the Republican Party as the non-black party. And this notion of the Republican Party as the non-black party is something that's very, very important when you look from 68 on. There were countless other examples of dog whistle politics, whether it was, you know, Reagan's welfare queen or the Willie Horton issue or the demand around law and order. So you don't have, while you don't have the explicit reaffirmation of Jim Crow segregation, black inferiority, et cetera, there are these codes that white people pick up on. I mean, black people obviously pick on it. We know exactly what's going on. But white people pick up on it, and they are often able to rationalize this as not really being racist. You know, it's not really when Reagan was talking about the welfare queen, he's not really talking about black people. He's just talking about, and then you just fill in the blank.
So
now what happened in 2015? I'm sorry, go ahead.
When Trump says, why do we need the people from Haiti? Let's get more people from Norway. That's not really about race, right?
Well, no. See, no. What's important about Trump is the end of dog whistle politics and the return of bugle politics. He is being very explicit in his racism, very explicit. When he started his campaign, and what does he say? One of the first things he does is attack Mexicans. And he identifies Mexicans as being the major source of crime. And he says, well, you know, there are some good Mexicans. But, you know, that's obviously a throwaway line because the main point was about racializing the target group, smearing them. I mean, there's nothing subtle in what he has been doing. When he talks this past week in his horrible statement about one quarter of the planet, when he attacks Africa, Haiti, El Salvador, other places, and says that they're S-holes, there's no subtelty there. That's not dog whistle politics. That's bugle politics. And I think that when I hear these right-wingers rationalize this and say that he is only using the words of his base, as if that justifies it? I mean, no, this is bugle politics, and he is rallying his troops to a white nationalist, right-wing populist agenda. And that's what's different, right? The subtleties are gone.
Well, let me ask you this. You're saying that he is rallying his people, his Make America Great Again folks, to his way of thinking, his politics, and his interest in white nationalism. So how do you explain the persons of color who, at least on camera, support him?
Every time there was a slave revolt in history, there was always a handkerchief head within the ranks that wanted to run back and tell Massa that the slaves are getting out of control.
Period.
That's my answer.
Period, end of story.
That's right. I really don't think much more needs to be said, because these individuals are, frankly, irrelevant. They're politically irrelevant. They're vacuous. But they serve the same role as the slaves that sold out various uprisings throughout our history.
You know, as we talk about your work and the history that you explain so eloquently, I have to wonder what this feels like just for you as a human being, as a man, and particularly as a black man in the world today. You have consistently fought for the rights of all. How do you get rest at the end of the day? Do you rest at the end of the day? The work seems so never-ending.
This is an interesting question. I do rest, but let me tell you how I feel. Virtually, well, every day, when I wake up, I do my email and I check the news. And the first thing I look to see is whether we're at war with North Korea. And I have been on edge ever since November 8th, 2016. In this past spring, my stomach was really irritating me. I have, you know, various gastrointestinal issues. And I went to talk to my doctor, and I said, that what I was going through, and I said, I really started to wonder, does this have to do with Trump? You know, I mean, I said, I've just been anxious ever since this guy got elected. And the doctor took me very seriously. And he said, I can't tell you how many of my patients have asked me exactly the same thing. The level of anxiety that I see is more than at any other point, prolonged period of time that I can remember in my lifetime. And it wears at you. And this is one of the reasons it's important to have supportive environments. It's important to be able to figure out ways that you can decompress. And you have to take a long view. You have to. You know, we often think of history, unfortunately, as linear and always progressing. It's always moving forward, and things are always ultimately getting better. And, of course, there's that famous saying that King had, that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And that's a useful saying. But what it doesn't convey sufficiently is that things can go backwards. You can lose, which means that you have to be thinking long term, not in terms of 1 year, 5 years, or whatever, but you have to be thinking about decades. And that's one of the things that I have to force myself to do. You know, this is not where I believed that I and progressive social movements in the United States would be in 2018. It's not. I'd be lying. I have been a fan of science fiction for years. And there's certain dystopian visions like the famous film Blade Runner and the work of William Gibson that I've read and always known that a dystopia is possible. But having said that, I didn't quite believe that we would get to this level of lunacy that we have.
Bill, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will absolutely continue.
All right. Thank you.
As you were talking about your own physical discomfort and wondering if it had anything to do with Trump, I am reminded certainly of the many people, black, white, male, female, who have been in my office expressing the exact same thing. I'm anxious, I'm worried, I'm scared. How do I talk to my children? How do I try to grow the moral compass in my family when there seems to be none outside of my family? You know, I think about the number of people with trauma histories who, as Trump and more, have been exposed for the abusive ways in which they have treated women, has come more and more to light, that more and more people have experienced any number of things. Let me pivot to Alabama for a moment. There was certainly a person there who had quite the history of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and he was well on the ticket. He was certainly supported by many people. When he lost, in a blog that you wrote, you said you congratulated the people of Alabama for rejecting irrationalism, but you said the war was far from won. Say more about that.
You know, one of the things that confronts people when they're in a disaster is whether they're going to wait to be saved or whether they're going to save themselves. So I want to remind your listeners of the film The Poseidon Adventure, both the original as well as the redo of it. So the basic notion was this ocean liner is hit by a rogue wave and capsizes. And a lot of people are killed, but a lot of people are in this banquet area. And they're still alive, and there's air in the ship. And there's a debate that breaks out about what to do. And the main person in charge, the ranking person, tells everybody, we should just stay here and wait for help. Help will arrive. And then there are other people that say, no, this bubble that we're in will ultimately break. And we have to have a plan to get out. And the best plan is to go to what used to be the bottom of the ship, which is now the top of the ship. And we've got to get out, and we've got to move fast. And a group of people do leave. And those that did not leave are soon killed when the water enters in and drowns them. That's the issue with any disaster. You have to have a plan. And when people sit back and they think that somebody will save them, that is when you're going to drown. And that's what's so unfortunate, to go full circle to the issue of King. It's so unfortunate that King was canonized, treated as a savior. The same with Malcolm. And for many of us thinking we need another King, we need another Malcolm. No, actually, we need a plan. We need a strategy. And when you have a plan, when you have a strategy, that's what inspires optimism. It's not simply an individual. And that's what people have to keep in mind facing what we're facing here. And that was what was beautiful about Alabama. There was a plan. And there was, and the black electorate was inspired in a way that shocked everybody. And the black electorate said, no, we're simply not going to tolerate that. But what we have to understand is that while they won, they have to keep Senator Jones accountable. But we also have multiple struggles around the country, and we should be learning the lessons from Alabama. So it means that we have to have a plan and not simply doing what has been done in the past, things that have frequently frequently failed. So, I mean, in a peculiar way, Pam, that's why I'm actually optimistic, because I think that we actually can turn this around, but we do have to think in the longer term. And we have to understand that we are in an asymmetric situation. And that means that the resources on the other side are astronomical. And we need to understand, we'll never have those resources as long as we're not in power. We'll never. So we therefore need to stop crying about it and stop, you know, throwing up our hands. And instead understand that with the tools that we do have, how do we go about winning? That's the discussion that I encourage everyone to have, and it's a discussion that I try to pursue.
And to those who say, what tools? We don't have any money. What do you say?
We've got people. We have people, and that's what they had in Alabama. And we also actually do have money. We don't have, by and large, the Koch brothers. You know, that kind of money of the right wing. But we do have money, and we have money among ourselves. One of the things, and I'm speaking here to and about African Americans, and I'm going to say something that will irritate many people, I know. So I'm going to apologize in advance. That in my experience, far too many African Americans are prepared to pay our way into heaven, but not pay our way out of hell. We will contribute disproportionately to religious institutions. Disproportionately. This is documented. But when it comes to contributing to social justice movements, we act like that's not for us to contribute. Let the white folks do it. You know, if you have a social justice organization, go to a foundation. Get the money from them. But we don't need to give up their money, but we do need to give up the money for church. And I'm saying that there needs to be for us to win, there needs to be a reshaping of the way that we think about how one gains the resources that are necessary. Because none of this happens on magic. None of this happens on air. It happens through resources, and some of those resources are volunteer resources. You know, people actually spend time. I mean, many people have forgotten how much has been done and how much needs to be done by volunteers. But the other thing is contributions. And I think about what happened, for example, in both the Barack Obama campaign of 2008 as well as the Bernie Sanders campaign of 2016, and how much was obtained through relatively minor contributions, but by a lot of people. That's the example that we need to emulate.
When you describe it in that way, although you're right, I think that you've probably irritated a number of people, but they'll survive. But when you describe it in that way, that the more we get together, you know, 10 people contributing $1 in a lot of ways is a lot more powerful than one person contributing 10, because those 10 $1 folks, they're committed and they're going to contribute more than that dollar in theory.
That's true.
Energy.
That's right. And more than likely, and particularly in this age of social media, they will convey to other people, well, I just made this $10 contribution, so maybe you can too.
Right.
I mean, so you end up getting not simply contributors, as important as that is, but you get people that are going to be evangelists for your movement or for your cause. And that becomes essential. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I think about, you know, as a host of a show on WPFW in D.C., when we do the fundraising drives, I always try to convey that people should contribute what they can. They shouldn't, like, think about, well, I can't make this major contribution, therefore I can't contribute anything. If you can contribute $5, that's great. And that's the way you build a movement. That's the way you build a movement. That's the way the union movement was built. That's the way the Black Freedom Movement was built. Certainly, we need and can utilize major contributions. But it's important that the movement relies as much as it can on its own base. Because when you rely on others, then others can influence your objectives.
Speaking of movements, we spend just internationally, we spend a lot of energy on the current sitting president, who and what he is and who and what he isn't. But in some circles, there appears to be a movement on behalf of the vice president. What do you think about Pence? Is he going to be, should he decide to make a bid for the office? How's he going to be helpful to labor?
He won't be. Pence is as dangerous as Trump, but he's not a lunatic. So it's important to understand that when we succeed in pushing Trump out of office, Pence will be nothing to write home about. But he will be more predictable. What we're dealing with is actually a regime. It's not just an individual. We're dealing with a regime, and this regime seeks to overturn the 20th century. It seeks to overturn the victories that were won from the first decade of the 20th century on. That's their objective. When they're talking about taxes, this tax bill, which is absolutely horrible. When you look at the repeal of various forms of regulation, including around the environment, all of this is aimed at taking us back pre-New Deal, and in fact, pre-Woodrow Wilson, to an era when there was very little role for government. And that's part of what Pence represents. So when Trump moves on and is encouraged to retire, his replacement will not be to the benefit of progressive and liberal-minded people. It will just be a different battleground, that's all.
So it sounds like what you're essentially saying is that when, not only do we need to have a plan, but when you think about your plan, when you consider your strategy, you need to be not so individually focused on a thing or a person, but you need to have a broad view. You need to have the long view so that the plan is actually a plan that will be effective.
And I think that's the best way to celebrate the work of Martin Luther King. You know, I mean, when you look at the work of King, King was not focused on who was going to be in the White House, although certain people he supported. He was focused on broader movement objectives, whether it was the Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65, speaking out against the Vietnam War, building a poor people's movement. It was these broader issues that were aimed at transforming the United States. And I think that is the way we celebrate the life and work of King, to emulate that. And I would say that speaks against this sometimes comical, sometimes upsetting rally around Oprah Winfrey for president that we started to see after the Golden Globes. The issue that faces us, and this is not about Oprah pro or con, the issue that faces us is not mainly who the next president is. It's about what steps do we need to take that move us towards transformation. We have battles at the state level that are so important because it could lay the foundation one way or the other as to whether the right wing can convene a federal constitutional convention. So you could get Oprah or someone else in, and it won't make a difference because of what's happening at the state levels. The thinking that King was pushing was, let's look broadly, let's think about the strategic objectives and how each battle fits in towards us getting to our final goal.
Bill Fletcher Jr., how do people learn more about what you are doing?
I have a website, which is BillFletcherJr.com, and it's all one word, Bill Fletcher Jr., and Jr. is J-R. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, and I can tell you that when I'm on Facebook, Pam, my preoccupation is not the kind of coffee that I've had in the morning or what I'm going to be doing during the day. I look at Facebook as, at its best, and Twitter, educational tools.
So if I go
and I encourage people to interact with me on this.
If I go to your Facebook page, you mean I'm not going to see a picture of your breakfast or your dinner?
You won't. I have to disappoint you, but that's not what I do. And I post things, offer commentaries, and I also encourage people to listen to me on WPFW on Friday mornings in my show Arise, which you can also listen to. It's a podcast and PFW archives.
And so how do they access you on that? What's the web address if they want to listen online?
If they want to listen, they can go to WPFWFM.org and go to archives, and then my show is called Arise, A-R-I-S-E.
Okay.
And I'm on every Friday morning.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Bill Fletcher Jr., for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And folks, thank you for joining us today. Remember that Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do on your own or with a professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. I'd love to know where in the world you are right now as you're listening to Mind Talk. So do send me an email at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that is MYNDTALK.org. And please remember always, if it is unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. You take care.